get things underway by welcoming back to the program, as we do each Tuesday afternoon, our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
How's it going? I was chewing a peppermint there, and I barely got it in on time. I was like in chipmunk mode.
I would wait for you to finish your peppermint. You know that.
Yeah, it was pretty good. Yeah.
I hope so. You know what also was pretty good, he said in a really awkward segue. Man, your new short story that appears in the current Boulevard, Hold Until Relieved. Man, oh man, I'm not saying it because you're here, because that's not how I roll. Gosh, the character development that you're able to do in less than 10 pages is some impressive stuff.
I think there can be misguided notions of time, space, size with writing. And there are, for instance, all kinds of ways for something to be long. Now, if you read a Chekhov story, for instance, it might be page count-wise two or three pages long, which we don't think of as very much, but it can be very emotionally long, it can be very spiritually long, it can be very intellectually long, and then conversely, you can see some novel just loaded up with pretentious literary tropes and description for description's sake, and it can be a bloated, right, phlegmatic 550 pages that could have been done mediocrely in half a page, but saved everyone a lot of time. So I really tend not to measure or weigh things that way, but there's something I think of called instant tone. And the better you are at writing, the better you're able to establish instant tone. Instant tone is something that should be there in the first few words of anything you write. A lot of times you'll see like writing 101 and subject-verb sentence, and I watched the cows come home, I did this, I did that. And it doesn't really add up to any kind of rhythm. And that's really the antithesis of everything that I try to do, and I think really the antithesis of what this story does.
Well, yeah, here's an opening sentence. For a long time, I wondered what that beaver must have thought when he came home to find a frozen dead kid in his den.
Right. Now, so, like, pretend you're a batter in baseball, right? You're up at the plate, and you take your first step towards the pitcher. You want that step, your plan foot. You want it to go hard into the earth. Or if you're a quarterback and you're coming out under the center, you're lined up with him, your hips with his hips. When you take the snap, your hips swivel. There's that very powerful torque. And in that sentence, right away, I've stuck my foot in the ground. You can see the torque of my hips. And it continues on. My sister Jamie was bigger than I was, but I was 16 months older. Big brother, protector, all of that. We played hockey out in the pond in Reliquary Woods behind our house. When she skated by the beavers, then the ice broke and she went under, I had a thought I shouldn't have about how beavers were her favorite animal. She liked how they imposed their will on their surroundings. It was her go-to animal fact. That's where the ice was weakest, because that's where the beaver would pop himself out and take a look around. I thought about that the last time I saw her after they had pulled her out. She was the color of washed-out decorative cabbages you see in November. No one blamed me. That felt wrong. A big brother on the spot is supposed to be blamed. I could have begged for some blaming, but I didn't. I used to wonder what stopped me. My mother mostly sat in rooms in the dark by herself for a while. My dad sat alone in rooms, too, and at strange angles, as if he couldn't be fully upright, and his whole self had curved to the right, like a warped tree branch. He was a history professor who had just lost his job, and who was always telling you about how some master war strategist had outflanked someone else's army. He loved a proper outflanker. He gave me my name Maitland because that was a favorite Civil War general he liked, but he called me Ty on account of my middle name, Tiresias, because he could see so much, my father said, more than just about anyone, like it had been divined. I looked him up later in junior high and learned that he was blind. Did encounter my dad's zeal, though. All kinds of way to see, son. Now,
I love that line. Love that line from Maitland's father.
Sure. And it's like when people talk about how they travel. And I've been to 37 countries. Well, you know, there are all kinds of ways to travel, really, aren't there? Like, I don't go to other countries, but I would think anyone who has the vaguest familiarity with my work or has even heard this much of a single segment on here knows that guy's a traveler. So his father, who is something of a problem within this story, as you know, with someone who's read it, that's kind of his line of sagacity. And what the story is about is basically this kid who is the narrator, could be older when he's telling this story, but he was born with a twin sister, and that is not the twin sister that has suffered this horrible end. Because when he came out with the twin, family basically couldn't afford the two kids. So the one was put up for adoption, and he remained. And later there was this other sister, and she dies, and his brother has something approaching survivor's guilt. And he has this very good friend in the town, a girl named Farron, and we come to learn something about the nature of what may be their actual relationship when the boy's mother starts to lose it after the daughter, this kid's sister, dies.
And wonderful descriptions, analysis of how this family and how all of us both deal with and often fail to deal with tragedy, but some great descriptions too. I love your line about the father's whiskey always smelled like Bactine. That's just such a great description.
He drinks Talisker whiskey, which is actually a pretty good whiskey. And if you were a kid, though, and you did smell it, you could think that it had that kind of Bactine smell or a chlorine smell. And what this kid, Maitland, does is he walks laps, basically, around this pool at the school near his house at night. And it's his way of blowing off some kind of steam, emotional steam. And you also have that water imagery. He's wondering why he remains. And the father, he takes a job in a different place, in Denver, as it were, because he can't be around this situation. His wife is coming apart, and he basically leaves this young boy to hold until relieved. Now, that's a military term. If you've ever seen the film The Longest Day, 62, it's said a couple times in there. It's when, basically, you're being sacrificed. Someone says that to you, it's like going to be a really bad day. You're out at the bridge, and you're there with, like, six or seven of your comrades, and the general who's going off somewhere else to do something says, basically, you guys, you're the only ones here for a while. Hold until relieved. And that is what is being asked of this kid, because his father cannot handle this situation. And the father is calling in, and he's checking in on the phone or whatever. But a lot is being put on this kid's plate, as it were, and he is breaking down. So there is this section where he's coming home, and his mother is hanging out in his dead sister's room, and he doesn't really have anybody to turn to. And his mother basically conducts their relationship by leaving these creepy cards on the kitchen table when he comes in. There'll be like one polar bear, like a mother polar bear, and its baby polar bear lying on top of it. So he's all very creeped out. And there is this section that it builds to this head, really. And that was the day I basically lost the ability to read. Words look more like symbols than anything made up of letters. I went exploring. Through the closet, I felt my dad's ties, the dress my mom wore at the funeral. I visited the nightstand, counted the Agatha Christie books in the drawer. I opened the dresser. There were some condoms there. Mrs. Gorman was also the health teacher. She gave the sex ed lessons. After the giggles had stopped, we listened as she said a condom could fit over her arm, which she then proved. So there was no excuse not to use one. I thought about why I was there to walk around this room and how easily that could have not been the case. Twice-ish. I took one out and started unrolling it over the top of my head. I got it down over my eyes, my nose, my mouth. I breathed in. The white of the latex began to look yellowed, like the pages of an old library book. I breathed as hard as I could, felt the moisture from my breath tickle my skin, breathed deeper still, trying to inhale the world, as I got lighthearted and wondered what the beaver was up to, if he had gotten over what he had seen, what my dad was doing or pretending to do in Denver, what knickknack my mother was presently holding in her hands, and remembering every detail of how it came to end up in Jamie's room. I thought of the underside of ice and how it was always more yellow than the top. I thought of the bump there'd be on my head to go with the cuts in my hands as I fell backwards against the drawer, and my mother bent over me, having ripped the condom apart, holding me, scolding me, but not meaning any of those scolding words. I wondered what kind of animals would have been if we could have been depicted just then on the card, like the cards in the kitchen. I felt smaller than usual, so chipmunks maybe. And I felt spry, so probably chipmunks would have worked as I ran out of the house and left my mother there crying on the floor. It's like, you know, that's the kind of emotional heft that I think readers want and need and are as much moved by as entertained by that we very rarely get in fiction these days.
Well, it is terrific. It's in the current Boulevard and also will be part of a short story collection that looks to be out sometime in the spring.
That's a different one. The one coming out in the spring is called Buried on the Beaches, Cape Stories for Hooked Hearts and Driftwood Souls. And those stories are all set on different towns on Cape Cod, where you have the flora and the fauna of the Cape informing the lives of the characters, but with emotional resonance akin to a story like this. So if you lived in Tacoma and had no clue what Cape Cod was, you could connect with it. But contrary to what you say, Mr. Kimball, when you're like, Colin, you're sitting there, you don't do anything, you're a very lazy, slothful guy. I have a bunch of books, and so this isn't a different one.
Cheer Pack, right?
Yes, Cheer Pack.
Also wanted, while you have a moment, you want to talk about that Sam Cooke documentary on Netflix? I had a chance to watch that after you mentioned it over the weekend.
I thought for some reason when I first heard about it that it was one of those kind of like those fictive versions of like a musician. Do you know what I mean? Where you see like that actor who looks nothing like the guy and you go to the cutaway. But it's actually a really solid documentary. And the very first music you hear in it, and I like this, of course, but I also think it's emblematic of who Cooke was, is from the Harlem Square Club in 1963, from not Harlem, New York. It actually was a club in Miami, and I'm doing a book on it for Bloomsbury for their 33 and a third series. And I like that it didn't try to be this so much social justice warrior, pandering, fit the narrative. It told the honest-to-goodness truth of Sam Cooke, and it was great to me that it mentions his songwriting.
Yes.
People tend not to really focus on, and they highlight that line, right? The Cokes are in the icebox. And it's just so believable the way it dials in on that level of specificity of like a party, right? Having a party, the Cokes are in the icebox, like, hey, we're ready to go. This is going to be a great night. And I thought that was a really fair and balanced way to look at what he did, because that man could write himself some songs. And I think the way he sings, too, the way he would do these melismas, and within the melisma, he'd go down, he'd add vibrato. That's a form of writing. Just like this story is a form of writing, the way an artist uses a brush for a stroke is a form of writing. And again, I just think we've gotten too far removed from that right now. But even when he sang, Cooke was writing. So that was always something that stuck in my mind and informed how I viewed words on a page.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot, and was thinking about the conversation we'd had here on the show about Sam Cooke, and good to see them go down some of those same roads. But yeah, it was a worthy watch. I'm glad you mentioned it to me. Glad I got to see it.
You are a soulful guy, if there ever was one.
I am a soul stirrer when I can be, yes.
There you go.
Colin, always a pleasure, my friend. Check out the current Boulevard. Read the whole thing. You will love Hold Until Relieved. Go to Colin's website, colinflemminglit.com, and be looking for more, because he'll have many more things coming out, because that's what he does. He's talented, he's creative, and he's working his ass off out there. Colin, we thank you as always.
Okay, have a peppermint on me.
I will do that. We'll see you next week. Colin Fleming on Downtown.